Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. October 4th, 1957, America's Cold War arch-rival, the Soviet Union, launched Sputnik, the first spacecraft to orbit the Earth. The United States went ballistic with envy and fear. President John F. Kennedy announced America would go to the moon and marshaled American science to do that, and much more, the U.S. economy flourished. January 31st, 2006, George W. Bush sounded a new alarm in his State of the Union address. This time it is global competition challenging the United States, he said, and he outlined a new initiative to respond. Will it work? Up next on Point, Craig Barrett, chairman of Intel, and more on the challenge to American competitiveness now. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Michael Lemonick of Time Magazine. He wrote this week's cover story on American math and science education. Michael Lemonick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Take us straight into it first. What's the problem, before we talk about what the plan is, the broad outlines of the problem the president is addressing here?
The problem is that while America continues to lead the world in scientific and technological prowess in terms of pretty much anything you measure, the number of PhDs we graduate, the number of papers they publish, the number of inventions created here, and so on, that lead is not what it once was. And we are in real danger of actually falling behind other countries in our scientific achievements.
What are some of the indicators of that shrinking lead the U.S. holds?
Again, in those same measures I've talked about, we produce more PhDs than anybody else, but by a much smaller margin than we did 15, 20 years ago. Our investments in research and development, both public and private, have plummeted over the past two or three decades. I could go on and on. The number of people coming to this country to study is dropping. Really, just about any measure you choose.
And American students in math and in science, their performance, their passion for these fields.
Their performance is lagging behind the performance of kids in other countries, that is in high schools and elementary schools. And at the college level, fewer students are majoring in science, fewer of the students who start out majoring in science graduate in science, and fewer students are going on to advanced study in science, engineering, and other technical fields.
So there's the big picture, and it's a troubling one. That scientific foundation has been the foundation of an awful lot of American economic growth. So the president's stepping up and saying, let's do something about it with this American Competitiveness Initiative. What's the program? What's the proposal, Michael?
The proposal is that the president wants to create 70,000 new teachers in science and technical fields. He wants to beef up the tax credit given to businesses. He wants to give industry more and more incentive to invest itself, and he also wants to double federal funding of research in areas like nanotechnology, supercomputing, alternative energy.
How much of this is new? How much of this is repackaged programming that's already in the works?
Well, I mean, the tax incentives already exist, the research and development tax credits. He wants to make those permanent. But the other incentives are new. I mean, he really wants to increase this federal funding. Federal funding already exists for these basic areas of science, but he wants to double them, and he wants to train 70,000 additional high school science and math teachers in addition to what we already have. So it is new. It is definitely, it is not window dressing. It is a real program.
And the initial reception you see, is this, are people saying, here's the new post-Sputnik push, or something else?
At one level, the reception is very good, because unlike more and more presidential proposals these days, both Republicans and Democrats are enthusiastic. And in fact, both Republicans and Democrats have been urging the president to make some moves in this direction. And business leaders, who are also traditional Republican allies, have also been pushing. So there's a broad consensus that this is important, and this is one of the things in the president's budget that is almost certainly likely to pass Congress, if in fact Congress doesn't add to it. So that's the good news. the bad news is that this is nothing resembling post-Sputnik push. It's a very small drop in the bucket compared with the problem. And so while it's promising, it's not at all clear, and it's a promising first step, it's not at all clear how many more steps are coming and how effective they'll be.
Michael Lemonick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Lemonick, senior writer for Time magazine. He wrote this week's Time cover story, Is America Flunking Science? Joining me now is Craig Barrett, the chairman of Intel, the world's largest computer chip maker. He got his Ph.D. in materials science a few years back from Stanford in 1964. He rose to chief executive officer of Intel in 1993 and became its chairman last May. Craig Barrett, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
You watched the president speak last week, as many of us did, in the State of the Union address. Is this it? Is this the starting gun for a new era in American math and science?
I certainly hope so. I think that Michael did a very good job outlining the crisis that we're facing. It's not an immediate crisis. It's a slow creeping problem, but every indicator is sloped in the wrong direction. I think the president addressed most of this in his State of the Union message, and I think the scientific technical community were very happy with his comments.
What has gone wrong, in your view, Craig Barrett?
Well, I think if you look at all the indicators, you find that we have a basic problem in our K-12 education system where many of the teachers who are teaching math and science are not accredited or qualified in those subjects. The federal support of basic research in the engineering and physical sciences has been effectively flat to down for the last two decades. At the same time, we have been neglecting these areas. Many other countries with rich educational heritages have come into the world's economic system, China, India, Russia, Eastern Europe. So there's increased competition at a time we were slacking off.
So it's not as obvious and material as watching Sputnik in flight, but we're looking at the charts here of the advance of many of these competitors. What do you see at stake here, Craig Barrett? For the United States, it won't happen overnight. It won't happen in one orbit of the Earth. But over the next decade, more, what's at stake?
Ultimately, it's the standard of living in the United States. We have the highest standard of living in the world. We achieve that by adding more value to what our workers do. They're more productive and efficient than their counterparts around the world. That is related to the educational level of our workforce. If you find yourself slipping off in education level, it's hard to imagine anything but slipping off in standard of living, slipping off in competitiveness. You get an indication of what this could be if you look at some of the Western European countries with their double-digit unemployment. They're a few years ahead of us down this slippery slope, and what we need to do is correct the situation now.
You saw what President Kennedy and the country did after Sputnik, in a way, with a Ph.D. in 1964. You were, in a sense, part of that. Is the president proposing anything like a Sputnik-scale response here? Do we need such a response?
Well, it's very difficult to duplicate Sputnik, which was this singular event. If you look for a topic, and the president touched on this in his State of the Union message as well, that topic would be probably energy and the energy crisis that the United States faces. Solution to the energy crisis and alternative energy sources, alternative fuels, will rely on investments in technology, investments in R&D, investments in the workforce.
From Troy, New York, we're joined by Shirley Ann Jackson. She's president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She was chair of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. She, like Craig Barrett, contributed to the National Academy's report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, that caught a lot of attention. Shirley Ann Jackson, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk with you.
We've talked about this before, about this quiet crisis, and you've continued to talk about it, sort of tried to raise the roof here. Do you see President Bush blowing the trumpet blast here that gets America in the game again?
Well, I think the following. I think the president's plan, along with recent congressional initiatives, does provide critical momentum for a new emphasis on innovation and the requirements that undergird it in this country. But my thoughts are fundamentally these, that innovation and competitiveness are all about human talent, and we have to keep the focus on that. And there's now a conversation underway. Initiatives have been advanced by the President and the Congress coming out of a lot of work from many groups, including the National Academy. And now we really have to close the gaps between the conversation and reality, between desire and reality.
So what is that going to take? It was just a year ago, Tom Friedman was quoting you, talking about the dramatic erosion in the U.S. position here, talking about you saying we're not going to have the scientific foundation to sustain our high standard of living. But Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, was harshly criticizing the Bush administration then for cutting back on funding to the National Science Foundation. Now, are we making real advances, Shirley Ann Jackson, in the president's proposal here, or are we kind of moving the deck chairs?
Well, I think the pros in the president's plan have to do with his science and math education proposals, along with support for basic research.
Are you talking about the 70,000 new teachers?
Well, he actually explicitly mentioned 70,000 and I believe 30,000 adjunct teachers.
People who would come in from science and engineering careers to supplement that.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. But I think a comprehensive plan must include the following. Support for basic research across a broad disciplinary front, including the physical sciences. The president has talked about that.
He's talked about it. Has he asked for the funding to do it? What would that take in terms of dollars?
Well, I think the overall package was one that was projected to be at $136 billion, but $86 billion of that was basically in the R&D tax credit. And so there's then $50 billion for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
He's talked about enhancements and an enhanced investment in K-12 science and mathematics education. And I think that the president's move in that direction is excellent, but I think there's some additional things that need to be included. And those additional things, I think, are these. One is direct funding for students pursuing degrees in science and engineering at the undergraduate and graduate level.
Scholarships.
Well, scholarships and portable fellowships that
okay.
are not unlike the NDEA fellowships that existed in the post-Sputnik era.
So let's put our money where our mouth is, student by student.
That's correct,
mm-hmm.
particularly competitive fellowships for the very best students.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, a recognition that we must access the complete talent pool, including those traditionally underrepresented in science and engineering, and I'm talking, of course, about women and underrepresented minorities, as well as continuing our openness to international students. I think, in addition, we need to think about creating a true discipline-based teacher corps, and that's whether those folks come after having spent time in other careers in science and engineering, or coming directly out of degree programs in science and engineering, and who may be interested in teaching. And finally, I would actually like to see an enhanced definition of R&D that would come under the tax credit to include traineeships and internship opportunities for undergraduates and graduate students in order to encourage corporations to bring them in at earlier stages in their careers.
So,
because the quiet crisis is really about the pipeline.
The pipeline, to keep it full, we've got a generation that's retiring. Get those new students trained up and get them connected with American industry.
Exactly.
Craig Barrett, that brings us right back around to your bailiwick, chairman of Intel, CEO there for many years. Explain the R&D tax credit to us and its importance.
Well, the R&D tax credit is basically a tax credit given to companies as they increase their R&D spending, their investment on innovation and new ideas each year. It has been an on-again, off-again rule in the U.S. It's approved on a temporary basis. The president is called to make it permanent, and therefore, if it's permanent, you can plan on it and put it into your financial plan for the future. It's a very good incentive to get American companies to invest in the future.
And what about American business investment in R&D in any case? We read that it has been falling away as the pressures for quarterly performance have grown. Is there a structural problem somehow in the market around R&D, in the fundamental dynamics of how American business is prodded and incented here?
If you divide R&D up into two fundamental segments, there's basic or long-range research and development, the sort of R&D that is now done in universities like Shirley's, RPI, and the other research universities in the United States. There's been a fall off in that basic long-term research and development done by corporations for a very simple reason. People have figured out that that sort of research benefits society as a whole. It doesn't necessarily benefit the company that does it. So it is research which is best supported by the government and then done in our universities. More applied research and development, or more development, new products, this is the sort of R&D that companies like Intel and Microsoft and Cisco and Hewlett-Packard and Dell do, and IBM. And for most of our companies, this has been increasing. For Intel, in our 38-year history, we basically increased our expenditure in research and development every year. This year will be in the range of $6 billion. If you want to put that $6 billion into perspective, that is about the National Science Foundation's entire budget for physical science and engineering R&D.
But as you say, that's for applied R&D. It seems you're suggesting if companies aren't going to do this, if it has to be universities and the government, that would suggest a lot more government support for university research, not less, not flat.
Well, what we're talking about here is not Tom Friedman criticizing President Bush for his lack of support of the NSF. This has been something that's been going on for decades, literally. So it's transcended Republican and Democratic administrations.
You mean that declining fundamental science funding?
The flatness of the physical science and engineering research budget from the federal government has been going on for decades. And what we've called for in the National Academies report and what the president suggested in his State of the Union message was to start to increase that R&D spending by the federal government, basic research support in the universities, in the national labs, to try to double that over a 5 or 10 year period, very much like the government has increased the National Institute of Health R&D budget, doubling that over the last 5 years or so.
Time to do it, maybe. We've got Craig Barrett with us, chairman of Intel, and Shirley Ann Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Let me turn to Rebecca, calling from Lincoln, Rhode Island. Hi, Rebecca, you're on the air.
I just wanted to make a point about the crisis in math and science in that I fear that the crisis is far worse than a lot of people think, particularly those in government and in power. I've only been teaching college now, I'd say, about 5 years.
Okay.
And even in the last 5 years, I've seen skills in students who want to be math majors that are so weak that they're not capable of doing basic algebra.
And these are students who want to be math majors.
Students who want to be math majors. And I don't really know how it happened, but their skills are very weak in algebra. And these are the types of skills that all college students used to be very, very capable of doing. And certainly all of my colleagues that I speak to throughout much of New England all say the same thing.
Rebecca, that's a scary report from the front line. Shirley Ann Jackson, here's university college-level teacher saying even her kids who want to be math majors don't have the stuff to do it these days. And she's seeing it falling. What's going on?
Well, I think three kinds of things need to happen. I don't disagree with her. Obviously, universities are on the receiving end of what comes out of the K-12 system.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think we need to go back to fundamentals in terms of education of students, even in the digital age, but education in fundamentals in math and the language arts. I mean, one cannot do calculus if one cannot do geometry, algebra, and trigonometry.
But that would seem obvious. Why is that not happening?
I think part of what is going on has to do with the cumulative nature of mathematics. And so one can't kind of go at it and flit in and out of it. It really is that each part is built on the other, and one cannot do algebra, trigonometry, and geometry without being able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. So that's number one. One has to go back to fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I think we have to infuse more real knowledge at the early grades of math and science, and that is why I believe very strongly that we need at least a cadre in every school and every school district of discipline-based teachers, people whose degrees are actually in these fields, who can get through an accelerated certification program and are given enhanced contracts for, let us say, 5 years that also allows them to work in industry.
So we don't have English majors teaching math, but actually mathematicians, you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. And the third point is that we have to meet students where they are, taking advantage of knowledge that people are developing about cognition and learning, about better use of technologies to help students deal with learning difficulties. And so it really takes that kind of thing, but you have to have that kind of knowledge embedded in the teachers. And then I think we have to help existing teachers upgrade their skills in math and science,
and,
because that is where the fundamentals will come from.
And Rebecca, we hope with all that that help will be on the way when the students hit your classroom. Mark is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually a math major from President Jackson's alma mater, MIT. And as she said, the cumulative thing is very important. And basically, I'm 23 years old. I spent my entire life studying very, very hard, the hardest mathematics in the universe. I'm about to get a degree, and I can't get a job. People don't understand my qualifications. They don't really care. They don't understand my resume. They don't understand how difficult it is, the stuff that's on there. And they don't have a use for me. Now, if I really wanted to make a living with my intelligence, I probably should have majored in business.
And we hear about people doing that, but how can it be that they don't want an MIT-trained mathematician? You should be a hot commodity if we've got such a vacuum out there.
Well, I'm not. Neither are my peers. Like, plenty of us are going into temp agencies. Now, I could go into teaching, but I've done teaching over the summer. And first of all, it's an 80-hour-a-week job, but it's paid, like, worse than McDonald's. It's not something you do. And even the people who are charitable enough to do it, they end up burnt out after a couple of years. So it's really, this is a lot of these requests are coming at a time where there's structural difficulties involved in promoting a math and science-based education, math and science-based jobs are just completely backwards. This is an extreme frustration among me and my MIT peers is that we're the best. You know, there's no doubting about it. We're probably some of the best in the world, but we wonder if all the effort was worth it when we can't find a job.
Wow. And, Mark, we've got it. Let me put that to Craig Barrett, chairman of Intel. Craig Barrett, what do you say to that? And let me put it in this context. I'm looking here at Intel's announcement from December last year, Intel to invest $1 billion in India in research and development there at the Bangalore Center and others, 2,800 employees at a place opened in 98, more to come, talking about long-term investment, $3.5 billion in Israel, billions or hundreds of millions in China. Are companies like your own hiring elsewhere already? Is there a gap in the hiring part of this cycle?
Well, let's put those announcements in perspective. We still do 80 to 90% of our engineering research and development in the United States. We've hired 10,000 employees in the last couple of years in the United States, primarily with technical backgrounds. So we are investing heavily in the U.S. as well as we invest outside. You have to recognize that companies like Intel, Cisco, Microsoft, IBM do the majority of their business outside of the United States today. The U.S. is not the only market that we operate in. 80% of our business is done outside of the U.S. So, yes, we hire employees outside of the U.S., but we're also hiring and investing in employees in the U.S.
So what do you make of our caller Mark's lament? Mathematician from MIT can't find a decent job.
Well, golly, you know, the last issue of Business Week magazine showed the importance of mathematics in just about every industry in the United States. If you look at the Fortune 500 companies, the most dominant or predominant background for CEOs is, in fact, engineering. I think there's great opportunity for people with good technical educations in the U.S. I don't know Mark's exact situation. Have him send me a copy of his resume.
Okay, Mark, you heard it. Right now, Fred is calling from Winthrop, Massachusetts. Hi, Fred, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
My point is that it's good to have, you know, all the money being directed towards, you know, the science and math. But additionally, I believe that the arts, such as music and art, also be highly exposed to these, you know, science majors, because that allows a broader form of thinking and conjecture with what they're learning in the science, so that they're thinking on a broader term, they're thinking more independent possibilities that they can run with.
Yeah, we've got it. Shirley Ann Jackson says, let's give them the fundamentals. And Fred, you're saying Let's get the creativity in there as well.
Can I make a comment on this, please?
Yes, please.
First of all, I think it's a mistake to think of education in science and math and engineering as learned and parroted back. There is much innovation in how those who study these fields in terms of how that happens and educating young people for global leadership. Secondly, we have to work the problem both ways. There needs to be a higher degree of scientific literacy in the general population, including those who would not be scientists and engineers. And in fact, we have a unique initiative underway at Rensselaer where we're building an experimental media and performing arts center, which will sit at the nexus of the arts and technology, which is meant to cross-feed between those two arenas.
It sounds great.
In a unique way. And so, but there, you know, there are a number of experiments like that going on. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind.
To crank it up from both sides. Yes, please, Craig Barrett.
I would agree with Fred. I mean, there are lots and lots of innovative ways to teach and to expose young people to mathematics and science. The whole issue of inquiry-based learning, where you learn by experimenting, and you can experiment in music, history, art, just about anything, and learn the basics and fundamentals, and they stick with you for life. This all comes back, though, to the basic issue that if you don't have qualified teachers in the K through 12 system who understand mathematics and science, they're not going to do a good job of teaching that. And if I can just give you a simple mathematical analysis of this, if you have to go through 12 years of mathematics, as you do, to major in engineering or math or science at the university level, and 30 to 40% of the teachers that you're going to have along the way are not certified or qualified in the subject they're teaching.
And is that the case now, generally?
That is the case today.
Wow.
The probability of getting 12 teachers in a row that are going to continue to turn you on, and it only takes one to turn you off, is vanishingly small. So what our current system is doing is it's set up because of the lack of sufficient number of qualified teachers to effectively filter out just about every kid who might want to be interested in the subject material.
Wow.
So the real secret here is getting the qualified teachers, and they'll bring the creativity. They'll bring Fred's art and music examples into the system. But they'll show kids how important the fundamentals of math and science are, not just to study engineering, but to live their lives to the fullest extent.
Mr. Barrett, I know we only have you for one more minute. At Intel, you've got to be looking out at this entire planet and all the competition out there. If we don't get our act together, what's it going to look like? How are India and China and the rest going to be coming on and eating the American lunch?
Well, I think the trends are there today. And if you look at the macro trend, which is the U.S. balance of trade deficit, which is running at $2 billion a day, that's an indication that other countries are getting more productive, more efficient, creating products, selling them back to us. Quite frankly, companies like Intel can do very well in the world marketplace without hiring another U.S. employee, even though we're U.S.-based companies.
Well, what about that? You described your commitment right now to the United States, and your personal commitment is clear, but could Intel just sort of float away and one day be a Shanghai company or a Bangalore company?
Well, Intel could be a U.S. based company with most of its employees outside of the U.S. But, you know, frankly, senior executives like myself in the U.S. have a conundrum. We have competing forces pulling on us. I have kids, and I have four grandkids in the United States. I want those children to have the opportunities in their professional careers that I had. And to do so, we need to fix the K through 12 education system. We need to invest more research and development. We need to maintain our lead in innovation. And that's what Shirley Jackson and I are talking about.
And how urgent is that, Craig Barrett?
If you read the National Academy's report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, it says, do it now. Every indicator is moving in the wrong direction for the U.S. Do it now.
Craig Barrett, chairman of Intel, joining us from Santa Clara, California. Mr. Barrett, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Chris is calling from Washington, D.C. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I have friends who worked for Intel before Mr. Barrett was at the helm, and I myself am ex-IBM as of 2 years ago, and I'm going into low tech. I really feel for the young man that called in from MIT a while ago, but certainly as I see it, the fundamental problem is that this economy and this culture in particular do not value engineering and teaching the way that they value things like business skills and lawyering. Here I am in the monument to lawyering, and on my way to meet a trademark attorney right now. But basically, the problem is that until this country learns to value these things and compensate better, you know, if you've got a need for engineers out in Santa Clara, California, and houses cost $1.4 million for a starter,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can't make that enough money to do that, well, you know, what are you going to do?
And you said low tech. What's the business you're moving into?
I'm moving into food. You can't export that.
Food. Okay, but you can't probably be a cutting-edge tech competitor either. Chris, we appreciate your perspective. Shirley Ann Jackson, what about this? Craig Barrett told our caller from MIT there's plenty of options out there, but every time we raise this issue, we get calls saying, you know what, there's not a market for my trained services. Can that be true?
Well, I think it can be, but I think one can be right on the facts and wrong about the point. And let me talk mm-hmm. about what I mean by mm-hmm. that. First of all, it is absolutely true that we must value science and engineering and those who do it. Part of the reason there's fertile territory outside the country, part of the reason there's rising competition from outside the United States, is that in those countries there is a national consensus that science and engineering is important for driving their economies and for their world leadership, their position in the world. We have to have the concomitant value in terms of how we perceive the role of science and engineering and those who do it, and understand how it has driven our economy over the last 50 years. The second is we need to have true leadership, true education for global leadership of our young people, not just to take specific jobs, but how to create new enterprises and how to lead in a global context, including outside this country, perhaps. And third, we need an expanded definition of what are acceptable careers with those in science and engineering, so that people don't define themselves too narrowly. And then I go back to an earlier point I made having to do with an expanded definition of the credits for which one can have an R&D tax credit, so that there is an increased focus on domestic investments, an increased focus on hiring our own young people while they're students and once they have degrees, and getting credit for doing that, to incent companies to do that. So I think all of these things are very important. Many people lament what goes on in the K-12 system. I'm a solutions-oriented person, and therefore I think it is very important to have discipline-based teachers to bring that true knowledge into the curriculum, the classroom, as well as working with existing teachers to upgrade their skills.
How big a start on that in the president's speech in the State of the Union address? If he's up the amplitude here, how close is he coming to the kind of clarion call the country needs?
Well, I think he's made an important start, but I think one should refer back to the National Academies report that I was a part of, where there was a specific recommendation for creating hundreds of thousands of teachers in this arena and upgrading the skills of the ones who exist. And so we have to focus on the young people, to invite them, to prepare them, and to celebrate them for doing science and math. We have to do very specific things to work on strengthening teacher skills, creating discipline-based teachers, and then we have to support those who do science and engineering and create the infrastructure.
And respond at the scale of the challenge. Shirley Ann Jackson, it's always good talking with you. We appreciate your being with us again today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care, Tom.
Shirley Ann Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.